We're looking at Philippians chapter 1. We didn't quite finish last time. We left off in verse 27. And really the whole thought of Paul up to this point, he's been explaining to the church of Philippi, the people there, some reasons why he's in the situation he's in. You know, they're looking at it as a bummer. Poor Paul, you know, in prison. And we're sending Epaphroditus to encourage him and to help him and maybe take some things that he might need. But poor Paul. And if Paul's in prison, what's going to become of us? And so there was this mentality, especially that they were in a Roman colony and under a little more persecution than normal places because of the decrees that went out from Rome. In fact, just a few years earlier, Rome had expelled all the Jews from Rome and realized Christians were a Jewish sect at that time. So they were included to that whole thing. And so there was a lot of persecution going on, and they were wondering. And so Paul was saying, hey, it's worked out for the better. It's been great. You know, the gospel has gone forth. I'm encouraged. You're praying for me. And we looked at some of those things last time. And so there's an application now that, as you see his attitude of one of joy and confidence, there's an application that he goes on to speak about that I think is very essential. And I would call this conduct worthy of the gospel, because that's what Paul then says. He says in verse 27, only, or in light of all this, let your conduct be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come or see you or am absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, and not in any way terrified by your adversaries, which is to them a proof of perdition, but to you of salvation, and that from God. For to you it has been granted on behalf of Christ not only to believe in him, but also to suffer for his sake, having the same conflict which you saw in me and now here is in me. Now, Paul is mentioning this concept of conduct, although this is a different word that's normally used. When In Ephesians, he said, I, a prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you've been called. The same thought is here. To walk worthy of your calling. But here he says that your conduct be worthy. Now, this word is only found a couple of places here and in Acts 23. And it's a word in the Greek that actually I'll probably butcher it trying to pronounce it. But it's called politeu ahame. And that's a bad pronunciation, but we get the word politics from it, or polity, or polis, from which you see a city, a metropolis, which would be a city. Now, what he's saying is this. It's an old word that basically says to live as a citizen. So he's saying, be a good citizen worthy of the gospel. Now, there's a little play here, because they would have understood citizenship. And later he talks about citizenship and he says, hey, our citizenship is in heaven. You know, they would have known Roman citizenship and the privileges that went with that, just like we know American citizenship. And there are certain privileges living in America when you go into various countries. You've got rights that are very strong. Your entire country stands behind you. And that's a great privilege. But when he writes this, he's playing with the word. He wants them to not only think of their Roman citizenship, but he wants them to think in terms of now they're new to citizenship. Their citizenship in heaven, by which they've received the gospel. And they've received this incredible thing from the Lord. Now he's saying, walk worthy of that citizenship. Now Paul applies this to them in a number of ways. The idea to conduct themselves as citizens or to be worthy is something that he implies that there is conduct. There is things that we can do as Christians that are really not worthy of the gospel. Now, oftentimes Satan can really condemn us. Because, you know, one thing that happens when you come to the Lord, you know you're not perfect. You know God is dealing with you in a lot of ways. And I don't care whether you've been walking as 1 year in the Lord or 20 years in the Lord. There are still things the Lord is fingering and dealing with you on and putting his thumb on, saying, we've got to deal with this. And you never overcome that. Well, Satan can come in and condemn you for those things and say, well, you're not worthy. But the idea is realizing that our walk needs to be adjusted to be worthy of that gospel. And that's what the Lord is doing in our life. The idea here is this. As an American citizen, When you go into another land, you're representing, really, in a sense, your country. People look at you and they draw opinions of Americans as a result of seeing you. This didn't work out too good for me when I traveled to France 1 year in college. I remember hitchhiking across. We were studying in England for some time, and I hitchhiked and went across, got into France and did some hitchhiking there. And we got into Paris, and it was a tough, tough time of my life because I found out real quick that they didn't like Americans that well at that time. I don't know what policies were going on at the time, but Americans were not loved. And I felt the brunt of that as an American. And I found out later that it was because a lot of the tourists that have went through Paris really had such an attitude in the way they treated people that people got fed up with Americans. And that attitude reflected on our country, and they had a hatred for Americans as a result of that, or an animosity at least. At least I felt it. I remember trying to find a place there in the middle of night. We got in late, and we were trying everywhere. And all these places, you know, they said, well, we don't speak English. And so we were like going away, and later I found out they did, but they just didn't like us. And we ended up sleeping on the street in Paris, and I heard the Hare Krishnas over in the corner doing their thing. And it was a wild experience, but I remember just because of that. Now, to me, that implies Americans left a picture of themselves. Now, what kind of a fragrance or picture do you leave of Christianity? Now, I know that Christians are the number one reason why people become Christians. But they're also the number one reason why people stay far away from God, because they've seen bad examples. There was a call on our voicemail this last week that was quite amusing when I got back to hear it. It was a call that said, you know, Pastor, I think you better do a message on relationships because you've got a bunch of crackpots there in that church, you know. And I heard this message, and I'm like, she didn't leave a name. Okay. Well, I agree. You know, there are some cracked pots here, I'm sure. We've all, you know, we're all vessels under the Lord, and some of us have some cracks the Lord is trying to deal with, and some of us are very cracked up. But thank God, you know, that though a person might experience that, hopefully the Lord will also show them the other side, that there are people that are genuine and God has done a work in their life. And though they're not what they're going to be when the Lord's finished with them, they're not what they used to be. You know, can you imagine us trying to be together in this one room, being what we used to be, all of us? Forget about it. It would never happen. Or as my New York friends say, forget about it. It won't happen. So in a way, here's the idea. There is a conduct worthy. There is a conduct worthy of the gospel. And that the idea here is that Paul says, not only when I'm with you. Now, here's an interesting thing. Paul says, whether I come or whether I'm absent, that he didn't want their faith or their walk with the Lord to only be simply based on who was watching or who they were around. You know, that can happen to people too. Their conduct following the Lord is based upon, well, who they're around. If they're around a bunch of Christians, their behavior conforms to that. And they can talk the spiritual lingo and they can hang out and be a Christian for a day. But then when they're around other people, forget it. You'd never know they're a Christian. And Paul says, no, that's not what it is. Whether I'm absent, whether I see you or whether I'm absent, I might hear of your affairs, that there is a conduct worthy. It's an interesting illustration. In the Old Testament, there was a king by the name of Jehoash. And in 2 Kings chapter 12, this story of his unfolds. And the interesting thing about this guy was that there was a very influential man in his life who was the high priest at that time, Jehoiada. And Jehoiada had a heart for God. And he influenced Jehoash from a very young age to follow the Lord and to stand fast. And Jehoash then took the kingdom, and he really leaned upon Jehoiada. And it says that Jehoash followed the Lord diligently all the days of Jehoiada the priest. But there was a little interesting thing there. It was kind of like all the days of Jehoiada the priest. But when Jehoiada the priest died, something happened in Jehoash. It's almost like his true colors came out. And that he started, you know, dealing wrongly with the people of God. And he started doing things that were wrong. And when one of the sons of Jehoiada came to rebuke him, he had him killed. Can you imagine returning the favor of Jehoiada the priest by killing his own son? The thing that stood out about him was that he was an environmental follower of God. When the environment was right, he'd follow the Lord. But when it wasn't suiting, when he didn't have the influence, he fell away. Now, I know that for all of us, there is a strong exhortation for us to be in fellowship, because when you find yourself getting out of fellowship, it's very quickly you can dry up. You know that. But you have to make a choice to be in fellowship. You know, there needs to be a concrete thing in your life where you say, hey, it's got to be done. I've got to get fellowship. I need it. But even if you were in a position where you couldn't get it, what would you believe? How would your walk be different? You know, it's a question, and Paul really exhorts them that their conduct would be whether he was absent or present. Now, there are some signs you can tell whether your faith is an environmental faith, so to speak, or if it's a faith based upon the people you're around or the circumstances you're around. Number one is, do you find yourself praying openly but very rarely in private? You know, when the opportunity is there to say grace or to say something out loud, you say it, but privately you don't have much time in prayer. That may be a sign of an environmental faith. One could be reading the Bible when you're at church, but not in private. I mean, does your Bible just get thrown in the back seat of your car, and then by the next time you come to church, it's convenient. You don't have to look for it. It's right there because you haven't taken it out of the back seat of your car. You know, and there's not any time that you spend. A lack of personal closeness and dependence upon the Lord. That's a sign of just following the Lord with the crowd, jumping on the bandwagon. But that's not going to do you any good. It's really not stable. The Lord wants your conduct to be walking worthy of the gospel. Now realize what the gospel is. Now, the idea here is that knowing who you are in the Lord and what God has done for you. When Jesus died on the cross, what did that mean? What did it mean that he paid the penalty for your sin completely? There's nothing you have to add to it. There's nothing that you have to bargain for. It's yours. It's a free gift. What does that mean that your sins are forgiven, and that you are adopted into the family of God, that God looks at you as his own child? What does that mean to you? How rich do you understand, or how richly, should I say, do you understand your salvation? Because if you do, then your mindset of your walk will then be fitting that. In other words, if you know what God has done for you fully, you can't help but want to respond to follow him and say, Lord, here's my life. I want to go for it. I'm available for whatever you have for me. And it becomes an exciting adventure. Now, specifically, he gets into some areas of conduct. In fact, actually, there's a lot of exhortations in this whole passage, or in the whole chapter, in the whole book. But there are three things here that I think he points out for Christians. And he's really speaking personally. The first thing he mentions, he says, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith. Or basically, I would say that you stand fast in one spirit. That's the first thing. You stand fast in one spirit. Now, behaving as citizens of the kingdom involves standing fast against the things that would hurt your citizenship or harm you. The lure, for instance, of the world. You see, you're not of this world. If I were to go into another country, if I were to go into a third world country, for example, and I had a visa for 3 months to stay, but I decided to stay longer and then eventually got a job and then got settled in, and I totally forgot that I was an American. And I forgot to come back here because I got so involved in that. You see, it would not be my real home. What I was just passing through journeying, I've forgotten who I was, and I stayed in a place that wasn't where I was supposed to be. When you know what God's done for you, now when you go into the world, you realize this is not your home. You're just passing through. You're a stranger in this alien land. You know, and everything around you is foreign. It's not the real you anymore. All of its likes and the allurements of the world, the immorality and materialism, it's not you anymore. It's not the real you. There's still that part of you, don't misunderstand me, that you'll be attracted to that. It has its appeal because of our flesh is still present. But there's a higher part of you that says, hey, this isn't me anymore. I don't want this. You know, and so you have that dichotomy. There's that you desire the things of God, but you know you're lured and you're seduced by the things of this world, and you're like Paul in Romans 7, you know, wretched man that I am, who will deliver me? You know, with my mind I serve the things of God, or the things of this world, with my spirit I serve the things of God, and I'm like, it's driving me crazy. That's a part of a Christian experience. When you come into Romans 8, you find as he walks in the Spirit, he sees a whole difference. So the idea here is a conduct is standing fast. Now, unbelief can strike at many of you and hinder you. You need to stand fast against that. You need to stand fast against the deceitfulness of false doctrines. You need to stand fast against all kinds of things. And there are trials, too, that you'll face, that you'll need to stand fast. Remember the parable that Jesus spoke about that I find is very fascinating about the four different soils. The one soil that he described about the shallow soil when the seed would fall, and in when it spoke about the rocky soil, actually, in Israel today, when you're there, you'll understand this a little more clearly. When you think of rocky soil here, you might think of a field with a bunch of rocks in it that you have to pick out. There, the field is rock with a little veneer of soil on top of it. And when the seed gets planted there, it can start up because there's a little bit of soil, but there's no depth. As soon as the sun comes out, it'll fry everything because the roots can't go past the rock. Now, there's a good picture of what happens to people who first hear the Word of God, but then when trials come in, it really tests the depth of your belief. You know, if you really have had a vital relationship with the Lord, no matter what trial comes your way, it only draws you closer to the Lord. Your roots go deeper. But if you really haven't trusted in Him, if it's just been an opportunistic thing, well, I need something, I'll try that and see what happens. And when trials come, oh, forget it, I'm not going to go in that direction, and you leave, it means you really didn't have a true abiding faith. But when you stand fast, your roots are going deeper. I love it when I hear of Christians not only enduring trials, but rejoicing through them. I got real encouraged. Ray was telling me about Linda Dormey and the fellowship. I don't know, those of you who know her know that she has MS. She struggled with that for some years. And she just had a child recently, and it's really made her MS flare up. She's been flat on her back for about almost 4 weeks now. Hasn't been able to come to church. And Ray went over to visit her and see how she was doing, or call her on the phone. I don't know what he did, both, I guess. But he got totally encouraged because she's just rejoicing. She says, I wouldn't have it any other way right now. The Lord is speaking in my heart about so many neat things. And she's going on about how the Lord's encouraging her and helping her. And when I hear that, it's like, oh, Lord, that is so neat. You know, that encourages me. That makes me go, man, I want to just press on. What trials do I have in comparison to that? So that is standing fast. And that's a conduct worthy of the gospel. Hold fast. No matter what happens. In fact, that becomes an incredible picture to people, that there truly is a God in heaven when that thing happens, when you're standing fast no matter what is going on around you. The second thing he mentions is with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. Now, the second thing here involves unity. Now, this implies a temptation to not be in one mind. Now, by nature, God has made us all unique with unique personalities. And I can guarantee you, though you'll find a strong niche of friends here that you really understand and you have sweet fellowship with, there'll be another group in this church that you'll think they're on a different planet. As we definitely don't see eye to eye. And God has made us uniquely. You know, I mean, it's amazing when I think of that, how many people he's made and how individual we all are. No one person, no two people are alike. We're all unique. Even identical twins are totally unique in personality and temperament. It's amazing. And God has done it that way because he is a God of variety. And yet, he desires for us as believers to have unity in our understanding. Now, the problem comes in with our old nature. Our old nature can easily get provoked. I think of our old nature like a teen, you know, that gets easily caught up with the bundle of self, and it's so easy to provoke them and to push their buttons. And You know, the funny thing is, we're dealing with this. I might have even used this illustration. I don't even remember. If I have, forgive me. But I think of our teens and, you know, the whole challenge of us in raising children. And if you're a parent, you know what I'm talking about with sibling rivalry that comes in. The challenge is this. It's not so much to try to keep someone from teasing another or, as we call it, pushing their buttons. The real challenge is for us to not have any buttons to push. I mean, to me, that's more freedom. If someone's able to push my buttons, then I'm not free. If someone's able to get me angry or get me frustrated or get me upset, then I'm not really free. I'm more free when, try as someone may to push my buttons, it's like it doesn't matter to me. It's like it doesn't hurt. I'm not easily provoked. And you know, when you look at 1 Corinthians 13 about love, it's exactly what the Lord wants us to be. Love is not easily provoked. Are you finding yourself easily provoked by your husband or your wife or your children? Are you easily provoked by someone at work? Does someone know how to really push your button? And you just, like, every time you look at them, you know, ooh, they're going to push my buttons again, you know? Think about it. Maybe that's your problem, not their problem. Maybe it's not them. You know, I hear this all the time. You know, so-and-so made me do that. I can't believe how upset she made me get. Oh, really? You know, think about it. That's not scriptural. Jesus even said, we're defiled not by those things that come from without. We're defiled by what comes from within. Now, they have been the catalyst to the reaction. But, you know, all the chemicals were right there in you. You know, and it was all there. All it needed, you know, was just a little spark and bang, you're off to the races. Rather, come to a place where you don't have buttons to push. Be of the same mind toward one another. Don't set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble, Paul tells the Romans in chapter 12. He told the Corinthians, and this was, of course, one of their greatest problems, was divisions and factions and strivings. And he says, I want you to speak the same thing. Have a unity, that there be no divisions among you, but be perfectly joined together. It reminds me of an amusing situation. There were three churches on one corner in a little town. And in a hot evening, they'd have the windows open in the summertime, and they'd start their evening service all about the same time. And one church, you could hear them singing over there, will there be any stars in my crown? You know, the hymn. And we don't sing that around here, but I'm sure it's a beautiful song. But just about the time they finished that, you hear the other church chiming in with the song, No, Not One. And then when that was finished, the other church would start their hymn and it would go, Oh, that will be glory for me, you know. Well, that's kind of an amusing anecdote, but just the funny thing is, there is a lot of strife sometimes that happens between churches and even in the same church between people. And the bottom line is, Paul is saying one conduct worthy of the gospel is having one mind. Now, in that one mind, there's direction. You see, you need to be going somewhere. And this is the funny thing about relationships, too. And I've seen this with singles as well as in married. You need to have a vision. Now, by vision, where are you going? What's your goal? What do you want to see the Lord do in your life, in your marriage, in your relationship? For instance, when you think about dating someone, if you're a single person, the whole idea of dating, you know, really, it has to have a purpose. You have to have an objective. Because if you just get together for the sake of getting together and you get to know one another and you start going steady, you know, for the sake of just because you like each other's presence, but you're not really going anywhere, then you're going to have troubles. You need to have a vision. You need to have an objective and a goal and a direction. And the idea here for Christians is the same thing. You know, we could have all this feel-good unity among us in the world, which really wouldn't amount to a hill of beans, if we weren't striving together, going somewhere. In other words, with one mind, striving together for, notice, the faith of the gospel. That's the thing that our unity is revolved around. And that all implies who we are. We've believed in the gospel. So the faith, the belief in the gospel, the good news that Jesus died on the cross, gives us that sense of going together, striving together for that in this world. We are unified together. We need each other. Because there is a greater battle outside the doors. I want you to think of this. Every time you leave these doors, you're entering the mission field. Every time you drive out of the parking lot. Maybe you should think about it before you drive out of the parking lot. But every time you get out of the parking lot, you're entering now the mission field. You're entering now the mission field. And from the unity that you've had here, now the encouragement that you've had, you're going the same direction. You want to see others come to Jesus Christ. You want to see them know the Lord because you've seen what He's done in your life. You want to see that same thing happen. So with one mind, going together. Now this was true in the early church. You know, you read in Acts, with one mind they had unity, to continuing daily in the temple with one accord, you know, breaking bread from house to house in Acts 2. And you see this picture there of those who believed that they had one heart and one soul. They were so excited for what the Lord had done in their life. Unity is a very powerful thing. People see it and they wonder because it's not natural. You know, especially people who progress in their life, in their careers, they can become very isolated from other people. They become little, you know, kings in their ivory tower at what they do well. But it only isolates them more and more from people. And when you get three or four, quote unquote, experts in the same field together, they're all going to disagree, you know, because they all have different ways of looking at it. And unity is very difficult. In the world, you don't see a whole lot of it. And everyone wants to talk about unity, but that's all it is, talk. But in the church, there should be something. Now, there's an interesting story of an Indian I read this week, a man who has been used of the Lord mightily, but his story was fascinating. He was raised in a higher caste system in India. He was in line to become a very important person, and he was going to be married to another girl that was in a higher caste, and they had arranged the marriage, and everything was set. And some of his friends came over one day and says, "Hey, come on, let's go down by the river and tease some Christians. We'll mock them out. We hear some Christians are down there." So they, as good Hindus, very zealous for their Hinduism, went down to try to mock these Christians. And as they were harassing these Christians who were trying to share the gospel, one of the Christians said, "You know, one of these days you're going to have to stand before God and He's going to judge you for what you're doing." Well, this man went back to his house and thought, "Judge me." And he thought to himself, "Which God? There are 36 million Hindu gods. I wonder which one of them will judge me." And he's trying to think of this, and he's thinking, "I wonder which one." And he doesn't have any idea. So he went back to the Christian and said, "You know, there's 36 million gods. Which one's going to judge me?" And the Christian said, "Jesus will." And he laughed, "Oh, gosh, Jesus. He's not even an important God in the Hindu system." So, you know, he laughed about it, but there was something about this Christian that encouraged him to check it out further. So he came to a meeting. And at the meeting, he saw those of the lower caste system and the higher caste system all in the same room. Very unusual. He saw even some of the Muslim background there. And they were all together in unity, worshiping God. And that really bugged him, because he'd never seen anything like that. So he remembered, he went home just puzzled about this. And within a few weeks, he gave his heart to the Lord. And persecution then started in his own family. His father totally beat him and sent him out of the house. He lost his position in his caste. He became an untouchable. I mean, it was an entire thing that he went through. But eventually the Lord then encouraged him and used him in ministry. But the thing that stuck out in his mind was the unity there among people of such diverse backgrounds. Fascinating. Striving together. The idea of striving, literally, in the Greek word, is an athletic contest. It's a rare word. It's not used very often, even in the Greek language. But the idea here is that there is a striving together. There's a unity encouraging one another to succeed and to run the race. Now, with the unity comes a lot of good things. Old illustration I've used, there was a horse pulling contest, and the winning horse pulled 4,500 pounds. Second, 4,000 pounds. The first and the second guy got together and says, "I wonder what our horses could pull if they were hitched up together." They hitched them together, and the horses were able to pull 12,000 pounds. More than they could have pulled if both of them together. In unity, they were able to do more. And that is certainly true. When we're unified and we have a common goal and a desire, we really encourage each other to do more than we could do individually. Striving together. One body, many members. unity, striving together. There are those that drift around from church to church who never really get committed, who never really get plugged in. I kind of call them looky-loos, you know. They go here because there's this church program here they want to check, and then they hear about this and they go here, and they never get committed in any one individual local church. Problem. You see, there's not really a sense of striving together for the gospel. You're basically a sponge. You're taking wherever you can get, but you're not giving out that which the Lord would want you to. Don't be a looky-loo. Be one that gets committed. Maybe here, maybe somewhere else, but be committed so that there is a unity there. And that was Paul's desire for the Philippians, that with one mind they'd strive together for the faith of the gospel. Now, this is the goal. This is the picture. This is where we're going. We've got the gospel in our mind. And the gospel, we are not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Why? Because it's the power of God unto salvation, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. It gives us the power for salvation. Power. Power to live. Power to be forgiven. Power to be what God has called us to be. I cannot live the Christian life without His power. It would be the most difficult, it would be the most frustrating life in the world. In fact, if you took the Ten Commandments and a lot of the good things that Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount together as just, this is the teaching of Jesus Christ, now live it, you'll have a nervous breakdown unless you know the person of Jesus Christ. If you just tried to live His teachings and honestly do it to the best of your ability, you would fail miserably. You might be able to succeed in a number of them, but when he talks in the Sermon on the Mount about even dealing with attitudes, and even what you do in your heart is sin, well, who has not sinned? But the gospel goes much further than that. It's the power of God to salvation. It's His power to save us because of what He did by sending His Son on the cross. And that's where our motivation is. That's where our desire is. That's the message. And the implication is for us to believe. And when we believe, we become then little letters about the gospel, little epistles read of everyone. There was a little poem here. It says, you're writing a gospel right now. You're writing a gospel, a chapter each day by the deeds that you do and the words that you say. Men read what you write, whether faithful or true. Just what is the gospel according to you? It's a good question. What do people see? So the first thing, he says, stand fast, conduct worthy of the gospel. The second thing, with one mind striving together for the faith of the gospel. And the third thing, which is conduct worthy of the gospel, is this, that you would not in any way be terrified by your adversaries. This is the third thing. It involves not being afraid of your adversaries. Now, this implies a temptation for all of us at some time in our life to be intimidated, to be afraid. Christians walking in a manner worthy of the gospel, however, will not be troubled. Not by Satan, for Christ is greater in them than Satan. Not by the world, because Christ has overcome the world. Not by false teachers, though there will be people who will set traps for you, and maybe even not even know themselves. You know, the Bible describes of many deceivers as being deceived themselves. So you have to be careful. I mean, a cultic person may believe totally in what they're doing, but they're deceived, and they're deceiving others. But not to be afraid of that. Persecution, it will come. Jesus promised those that persecution would come, and he described, however, for us not to fear those who can kill the body, but are able to fear the one who can kill the soul too. Persecution is going to come. But we can boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear what man will do to me. And that's what he's saying. That's conduct worthy of the gospel. It's an indicator that there's something happening in you beyond yourself. By all natural consequences, it looks like, hey, I better watch out. You know, this is going to be tough. But in the Lord, you're saying, okay, Lord, I'm going to walk forward. I'm going to trust you to work it out. Amazing how he can do that. I want you to turn to Psalm 37 for a moment. This is a very important psalm. In fact, This last week, this came to our mind a couple of times. As we were reading through this, my wife and I were just encouraged with how it puts things in perspective. Do not fret because of evildoers, nor be envious of the workers of iniquity. For they soon shall be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and feed on His faithfulness. Delight yourself also in the Lord, and He'll give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in Him, and He shall bring it to pass. And He'll bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday. Rest in the Lord. Wait patiently for Him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. You're going to see that. It's going to be around you. You know, they get away with it. They seem to get away with it. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It only causes harm. For evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait on the Lord, they shall inherit the earth. You know, when we were down there in Florida, you always run into the little discount places and they want to sell you something. And they want to sell you this timeshare, which I would never tell anybody to buy one of those things. It just doesn't work out economically, but it's just these guys are really pushy. And I thought of this. I thought, well, you know what? Why should I buy this when it's all going to be mine eventually? You know, it's all mine. My father owns all this. Eventually he's going to give it to me. So why should I worry about buying it? I mean, I could, even now I could come down and enjoy it and I don't have to take care of it. It's great. Well, he didn't understand that one. But yet in a little while, the wicked, notice, shall be no more. And think about that. In a little while. I mean, the power systems of this world seem so impressive, don't they? It's a political year. And, you know, people are vying for power. People in politics have one thing in mind. Get power, and once they get it, maintain power. And that's it. That's politics. Get power, maintain power. Get power, maintain power. And if you listen to these guys, you'll understand that's where they're coming from. And I don't care who it is, unfortunately. Now, there are some good people in the field, but whether or not the American people are ready for a good leader is another question. But one, notice this, yet in a little while the wicked shall be no more. Indeed, you will look diligently for his place, and it shall be no more. But the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. The wicked plots against the just, and gnashes at him with his teeth. The Lord laughs at him, for he sees that his day is coming. The wicked have drawn the sword and have bent their bow to cast down the poor and needy, to slay those who are of upright conduct. Their sword shall enter their own heart, and their bows shall be broken. A little that the righteous has is better than the riches of many of the wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, and the Lord upholds the righteous. The Lord knows the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time. In the days of famine they shall be satisfied. But the wicked shall perish. And the enemies of the Lord, like the splendor of the meadows, shall vanish. Into smoke they shall vanish away. The wicked borrows and does not repay. If anybody has borrowed any of my books and hasn't returned them, I want you to read this. No. But the righteous shows mercy and gives. For those who are blessed by him shall inherit the earth, and those who are cursed by him shall be cut off. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delights in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. I have been young, and now I am old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his descendants begging bread. He is ever merciful and lends, and his descendants are blessed. Well, I'm going to stop there and let you read the rest of it on your own, but you get the picture. Why be terrified for your opponents or from your opponents? Why be terrified by your adversaries? Because when you're at peace, the scripture says here, that's a proof of perdition to them. There's something in that signifies they know their time is coming. The very fact that you can endure with rejoicing the persecution that they're giving, it unnerves them. It scares them. It's a sign. It's something that they know time is coming, that it will be payback. But to you, now here's the interesting thing. When you experience the power of the Holy Spirit in a time of persecution or difficulty, what does that do for you? Does that not make concrete in your mind more than ever before that the Lord is present and that He is yours and you're His? And that you've got that assurance, wow, Lord, you're really working. I know that many Christians would testify that during the times of the biggest trouble in their life were actually the times they wouldn't have traded for anything, because they were able to see that much more the Lord's commitment to them and faithfulness, how He strengthened them in the middle of a tough time. And usually it's the times when everything's fine, when there's not really a sense of, you know, oh God, help me, you know, I need your strength, but, you know, zippity-doo-dah, you know, everything's going your way kind of thing. Those are the times it's dangerous, because you begin to think, I'm okay, but then you're not really relying upon the Lord's power. Interesting thing to consider. So don't fear evildoers. Trust the Lord. Now, persecution is to be expected. It's promised to all those who live godly. Jesus said, in the world you'll have tribulation. We must, through many tribulations, enter the kingdom of God. He says in Acts 14. But our response should be to rejoice, knowing that He is going to work exceedingly abundantly above what we can ask or think. To the extent that as we partake of His sufferings, we're going to partake of His glory when it's revealed, and we'll be exceedingly joyful. Jesus said this in the Sermon on the Mount, when men revile you and persecute you and say all kinds of things against you falsely, rejoice because great is your reward in heaven. You know, what's the outcome? That's the key. I mean, wise investors will tell you, buy low, sell high. You know, make a lot of money. And that's good. Buy low, sell high. Well, you can't sell any higher than when you realize that the final outcome, the final dividend, is going to be eternal life forever and ever. So it makes sense, if you're wise investing, to put your trust in the Lord, to let your conduct be worthy of the gospel, to, whether you're around a Christian or not around a Christian, you're going to stand fast. That with one mind you're going to strive together. Striving together. There's a unity there. Striving together for the faith of the gospel. One mind. And not in any way terrified by your adversaries, which to them is a proof of perdition, but to you of salvation, and that from God. For to you it has been granted on behalf of Christ not only to believe in Him, but also to suffer for His sake. What he's saying is, as a reason you can be excited even when persecution comes, is that actually that's an opportunity. The apostles understood this. Remember when they, in Acts, if you're reading the story, and they first got persecuted and they were beaten and they were sent out, told, do not speak in the name of Jesus anymore by the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And they went out and they were rejoicing, oh, that they were counted worthy to suffer for His name's sake. Wow, what an opportunity. You know, I know in my own life that I can cloister myself to such a degree that I kind of can keep myself from experiencing any difficulty. I mean, I can keep my mouth shut and I'll be safe. No one will bother me. But if I open my mouth and testify for the Lord, there's the potential that I'll be persecuted. There's the potential that I'll be rejected. But I can be safe. Not say anything. I can be safe and just keep it cool. Don't let anybody know. I'm in secret service right now, you know. I don't want anybody to know I'm a Christian. Because it's safe there. But you know, in all labor, there's profit. Now, if you don't do anything, you won't get anywhere. And if you're not willing to take steps of faith, then you might never see persecution, but you'll also never see the power of God that gives you strength in that. And I'd rather go forward with the strength to go forward than stay still and be content there. And this is what Paul is saying. Go forward. Don't be afraid of your adversaries. Go forward. He didn't let anything stop him. I mean, he got stoned, dragged out of a city, left for dead. Lord brings him back to life. He goes back into the city. I mean, it must have been wild to go back in the city, you know, after they just stoned you and to confront them again. And man, what are you going to do with a guy like that? But you see, he understood the power of the Lord. Because any suffering that you go through, realize, number one, that it's comparatively light in light of eternity. It's nothing to be compared with the glory that's going to be revealed to you one day. And secondly, it's temporary. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. Now Paul says, having the same conflict which you saw in me and now here is in me. You know, God had granted them to believe in him and also to suffer for his sake, having the same conflict. Now the term conflict was agona, which is an athletic or gladiatorial contest. And they saw Paul when he came into town originally with Silas at Philippi. They first preached the gospel. They were treated horribly. They were thrown into prison, beaten, dragged from the marketplace, and just a horrible experience. And they remembered that. And then he says, and now you hear in me. You know, I'm in prison here in Rome. So he says, enjoying in that same conflict. Now, there again, there's a way to have very little conflict. Just don't do anything. Don't open your mouth. And you'll be safe. But you see, there won't be any reward in that. There's reward when you speak forth. You say, hey, I want to put my life on the line for you, Lord, because you've done so much for me. And then you do that, it's like it's exciting. If you do get an opportunity to see persecution, you'll see his power also. And if you don't sense his power at first, well then say, Lord, I'm not going to open my mouth again unless you empower me. You know, he will though. He will strengthen you. Here are the things that are involved in behaving as good citizens of heaven, worthy of the gospel. Number one, as he says here, stand fast. Two, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel. And three, don't be afraid. So in short, hold on, keep together, and don't be afraid. It could be that this is difficult when we forget the privileges that we have as Christians. But when we know what he has done for us, this is the natural response. In fact, all of the things that we do as Christians are really a response to what he has done for us. Christianity isn't us trying to be good little Christians so God will bless us. Christianity is experiencing the blessing of God and responding to that by walking worthy of what he has given to us.